This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you, in part, by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks, guys. Get all the true crime that's worth your time and heads ups about the stuff that's not every weekday for just $5 a month. Sign up at bestevidence.fyi. And now, our episode.
I don't think you can blame it all on football because lots of people play football. We've never seen an NFL guy in the middle of his success go out and start murdering people. So I don't think you can put it all on football, but would Aaron Hernandez be in this situation if he was a concert pianist? Probably not.
Netflix joins the teetering stack of Aaron Hernandez materials with Killer Inside, The Mind of Aaron Hernandez. But does the three-part docuseries tell us anything new about that mind? Later, another high-profile football player comes to a very different, untimely end in documentary The Tillman Story, obliging us to wonder which institution is more toxically cynical about the human beings who work for it, the NFL or the Army. Get your pads on. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 129. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast discussing how true crime is told and sold. I am thrilled that I've managed to sell our guest on appearing on here. Please welcome, for the first time, David J. Roth. Hello.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We are a little behind, I think, in caring about our most wanted topic today. Although, to tell you the truth, I wasn't feeling like a lot of people were caring about it anyway.
Yeah. I saw some kind of vague complaints for a little while, and then those kind of petered out, and that's when you strike. That's when you do your podcast.
I guess. Well, now that the petering out has occurred, let's look at the case file. This is from Netflix's press page for the series. Quote, as a gifted young football athlete from Bristol, Connecticut. That's a very weird phrasing, sorry.
It is. the famous type of athlete to be.
Yeah, I know. As opposed to football dancer?
Yeah.
Football artist? Aaron Hernandez had capitalized rapidly on his promise, playing for a top-tier college program before being drafted into the National Football League at the age of 20. But in 2013, fresh off a newly inked five-year, $40 million contract with the New England Patriots, Hernandez would become a household name for the most infamous murder case involving an American athlete since O.J. Simpson. Hernandez's trials for the brutal killing of Odin Lloyd and two Boston-area men yielded a Pandora's box of secrets, a tumultuous and often abusive upbringing, a growing fascination with gang life, and other discoveries that painted a maelstrom of motivations behind his violent behavior. A three-part documentary series featuring exclusive courtroom footage, Hernandez's phone calls from prison, and interviews with those who knew Hernandez and Lloyd, Killer Inside, The Mind of Aaron Hernandez meticulously examines the perfect storm of factors leading to the trial, conviction, and death of an athlete who seemingly had it all. End quote. That's a lot of...
That's actually exactly what I wanted to say about it. So
it's big talk that manages to kind of not really say anything, and that is kind of my overall take.
Yeah, that's definitely the broader vibe. It's like it has this kind of – there's like a Netflix thing that I generally have as like a complaint about their – not all but much of their content, which is that it's like – it's not artless – but it's not, it's like maybe not quite artful either. Like it's sort of neither TV nor HBO. And it's sort of just this kind of like everything here is professionally done. There's some stuff I didn't know about and some stuff I hadn't heard. And yet, like, as somebody who, you know, like I read a bit about the story because I had to, you know, edit things about it. And I don't think I ever wrote anything about it, you know, as part of the sports writer gig. Can't say that there was ever anything in there where I was like, oh, that's why this has to exist.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, overall, I think it is fairly artful in that way of certain Netflix properties where the way that it flows sort of distracts you from the fact that what is flowing is not new or particularly compelling mm-hmm. information.
I agree. Absolutely. So, very easy to watch, like professionally yeah. made. And yet, like, it never really, there's not, you know, it doesn't cohere into anything like, I mean, certainly not anything like here is why Aaron Hernandez murdered at least three people, probably. But it doesn't seem like it cohered into, like, even a series of, like, suspicions that I would consider, like, in, you know, tiered degrees of compellingness. Like, it was just kind of like, this guy had a lot of problems and, you know, whoever knows.
Well, and it, you know, was it any one of these things? Was it a combination of all of these things? Like, you know, this is one of those cases that I think we as a culture keep feeling compelled to turn over and over because we basically know, like 95% know why mm-hmm. what happened, but we don't 100% know. And that last 5% is going to bug us even though it's never coming. Right.
Yeah.
So like, I get why this was made. It's kind of the same reason they keep making Bundy projects. Like, what else is there to say about this yeah. guy? Nothing.
Yep.
But like, put his name in a hashtag and you're going to see some movement. Unfortunately, like, we all live in the world. It's yeah, fine.
I would say that we do indeed live in a society.
Yeah.
But there is definitely this element of like, it feels like the sort of thing where, like, you know, there hasn't been like another Hernandez documentary of this length. And like, instead of that being like a warning that maybe there isn't 3 hours and 22 minutes worth of stuff there, people were just like, well, this is our opportunity to be first on this.
Yeah, I guess. And apparently, I'm a little unclear on this aspect of the project's provenance, but evidently this was based on another documentary that was like only an hour by the same production team. And then this was expanded, I think, primarily to include speculation about his sexuality, which I've always felt was kind of it's easy for me to say that it's a who cares-er because, you know, I'm not trying to be gay in an NFL locker room. But on the other hand, like, again, this is kind of a who cares-er.
Yeah, I'm 100% who care on that one, especially if it's the sort of thing where you could... If there was a way to land it, if there were a sense of some insight into the many conflicts that, you know, sort of wound up destroying his life and or leading him to destroy his own life, then maybe it's there. But it's a sort of in the pot with a bunch of other stuff. And I feel like it shouldn't really be there unless you definitely have something to say about it. Like, otherwise it feels like, I mean, it's all handled respectfully, like, especially relative to the way that, you know, you briefly see how it was handled on Boston Sports Talk Radio, which, like, if you want to just take a minute to imagine how poorly you think it was handled, I assure you it sounds far worse than that.
Yeah.
Not just because of the accents either. Jesus Christ, it's a fucking yeah. chowder fight, like, big time in the little bit from WEEI they play. But like, all of that, if you don't have something to say there, then just sort of tossing it in, I'm not really sure about. They do have some stuff that was new to me. I knew that there was sort of that Boston Herald, EEI, like Boston gutter media coverage of some purported jailhouse relationship that he had. But I guess there's a guy that Hernandez had played high school football with who talked about having had a physical relationship with him over a course of years. And that, to me, was new.
Yeah,
but why? Yeah.
Right, but it was also like, at least this guy is in a position of having had an intimate relationship, whatever the like physical nature of it was. This was someone who was physically and emotionally intimate with this guy, presumably before at least CTE started to take over and perhaps change him into something else, and also yeah. before the like corrosive effects of consequence-free college sports stardom started to have their effect.
Yeah.
But here's
go ahead.
Here's my issue with this with this project is I think they needed to pick one angle and really dig in on that angle, and then maybe just iris out from Hernandez onto other stuff. Like, all right, let's hear clip two, which is one of my least favorite sports people talking about all the basically oppo research they do on their own players in the Patriots organization. Mr. Belichick, take it away.
As the coach of the team, you know, I'm primarily responsible for the people that we bring into the football operation. Our players are generally highly motivated and gifted athletes. They come from very different backgrounds. You know, as far as the whole process goes, I can tell you that we look at every player's history from the moment we start discussing it, going back to his family, where he grew up, what his lifestyle was like. We evaluate his performance, his intelligence, his work ethic, his motivation, his maturity, his improvement. And we try to project that into our organization.
I mean,
it would have been good. I think you could have not said Belichick's name and then just been like, just going off the energy level, who do you think this person is talking?
if we rule out Jeb Bush, who do you think it is?
It's extremely heavily medicated. That's if you play John Gruden's voice backwards, that's what you hear.
He really just is the most reluctant person to be like in a room with other people, given his job.
Terrible. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's stuff in there. There's a decent amount of like football stuff in this, given that like the promotional text that you read appeared to have been written by like a whatever, like you played an AI 45 minutes of Fox Sports and then like tried to get it to talk about football. Like, you know, there's a lot of weird verbiage in that.
Football athletes.
Yeah. Yes, football, the classic types of, yeah, there's a bit in here where Nancy Grace says the words football superstar, and that is going to haunt me for a little bit. Just say football player. Let's keep it simple and not gild the lily.
Yeah.
But the football stuff that's in here about the Patriots actually more or less rings true to me, and yet there's a lot of stuff that once you know the Patriots seems perverse and is never really like flagged as such, or even maybe understood as such by the filmmakers.
Yeah,
Bob Kraft comes like off in this as like just a real creep.
Yeah. There's that will be in our visual aids. Is Bob Kraft talking about the we really try to do things the Patriot way, and it's like, oh really, Risty like, McGee, is that right? How you try to do things?
I was gonna say, like, this is, and you know, Belichick, it seems like, so that's a bit that they get in there about the Patriot way, which for non NFL heads is basically this idea. It's sort of like in the way that all of the NFL is kind of like a secular version of the military with advertising in it, mm-hmm. that like the Patriots is like have actually taken that more seriously in terms of regimentation and sort of, you know, the way that roles are understood and that individuality is sort of subsumed into that. That like most of the NFL, when they do like sort of military cosplay stuff, it's about, you know, flyovers and like the one week a year where the coach wears like a camo windbreaker, mm-hmm. instead of a regular team logo one. Belichick is the son of a Navy family who seems to have some sort of weird issues about never having served himself, and so has created a sort of a weird fake Navy for himself in Foxborough. And that bit in there is understood, and then the idea of like how Hernandez as a guy who, for all of the other factors that you mentioned too, that like certainly the consequence three years that he spent in Florida as a superstar on a national championship team don't seem to have done him much good. But it's the same. I think that they could have been a little bit more explicit with that, for the same reason that emotionally immature people have been told to join the armed forces from time immemorial. There is this sense that some of the talking heads talk about, that Hernandez to the Patriots, maybe it'd be good for him. You know, three hots in a cot, a wake-up call every morning. Like, it does have this kind of he's understood in a very instrumental way as a Patriot. And I think that it sort of highlights how other NFL players are understood that way. But then it doesn't necessarily offer much of a window into how he bombed out of that system so much.
Well, and you're also getting a lot of stuff in that clip where, like, it's not dog whistling exactly, but there are a lot of sort of broad terms for, it's like how certain state correctional systems do not want to use the term solitary confinement, so they call it something else, like
administrative, you know, sequestration.
Yes,
or whatever.
Like the private time regiment, like regimented private time. Like, yeah, well, technically that's correct.
Yeah, like that's what those words mean, and yet I know what you're talking about.
Yes,
and that's not how you're
supposed
to do it.
Depending on where we put the hyphens, this is a whole different thing that we're talking about. But there are, like, his lifestyle, his background. So what he's both saying and not saying is some of these athletes of color are going to have to be told how to act correct, which is like, ugh. And then, then you're sort of into, then you're irising out without even necessarily meaning to onto the plantation system of the NCAA that supplies the NFL with like, if you're a D1 athlete at one of these colleges, perhaps you're fucking up and you're not having all that many consequences. And then when you're sent to the NFL, they can choose whether or not to straighten you out. And the Patriots are like, I don't even know what the equivalent is, but there's just a lot of like,
so, like, I would say, like, it's gross, like a military contractor or something like that.
Yeah.
The idea of being like, you know, whatever, this, he just works here. And like, and if he fucks up, then like we can wash our hands of the whole thing.
Yeah. So I think that,
which at the risk of a spoiler, they very readily do with Hernandez.
Yeah. But I think that this is probably the most productive narrative angle for a story about Aaron Hernandez to take, because it's like, would disciplinary action have averted any of this when he was in college? I don't know. I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And also, that wasn't the, fundamentally, that's not the business that the University of Florida's football program is in.
Well, no.
Just as it's not the one that any high D1 program is in. But that's, again, like you said, like we're into a different conversation, and one that, you know, it's honestly, it's one that Netflix could, had they wanted to, could much more readily have than, say, if ESPN were to try to make a documentary series about Aaron Hernandez.
Right.
Because Netflix doesn't have TV rights that could be turned off, you know, by NFL or by college football.
It also is having a conversation about it in shows like Last Chance U and QB1. But it didn't feel... There's sometimes the sense that the NFL and NFL films are not about to give anyone shit if the brief that they read is not sufficiently gentle towards the NFL's handling of their property, basically. So
for this incredibly like swaggering kind of like the way that the NFL talks about itself is as like almost like the way that like as a nation state talks about itself, like this kind of like the way that like it's like a fantasy version of America where you don't have to have like poverty programs or whatever, you know, but you can talk about like whatever, like we continue to lead in the space, like we continue to move aggressively to expand opportunities, whatever. It's like kind of like cop military language. They're also insanely thin-skinned if you're not solicitous to them.
Yep.
But in this case, you don't really need any of that, you know. I mean, it's just the sort of thing where I think that there's this broader challenge with, especially with the NFL and with its athletes, not just because of the abstraction that the NFL's understanding of itself and the way that it talks about itself builds into it, but I just think in general, thinking of NFL athletes as actual people seems significantly more challenging than it should be for even for stuff like this, which is comparatively searching in its approach to telling a story about an NFL player.
Yeah. Well, and even the NFL is not necessarily prepared to think about these things in terms of responsibility to or from anyone, certainly not themselves, but it's like, what is our responsibility to our players? What is our responsibility to our customers is what they're really interested in. And this is why I think if you asked the NFL or the Patriots, it's like, well, you know, we handled that situation as best we could with the information we had. To wit, he killed people and embarrassed us, so he's got to go. Like,
and we bought all of his jerseys back from fans that had them, so that we wouldn't have to see them out there in the street anymore.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's all very kind of grim, but again, it does. There's, you know, that is the way that the NFL sort of handles this. I think you're right on with that. That it's not a matter of responsibility so much as it's a matter of indemnity. And that all of that is sort of the way that this is understood all up and down the game. I mean, like, it is true that Hernandez probably committed the most murders by number of an active duty NFL player that I can think of.
Yeah.
But it's sort of mentioned in passing at the very end of it that there's Jovan Belcher, who appears briefly on screen, is not named, you know, shot his girlfriend, killed himself at the Chiefs facility. Another guy that, you know, had serious emotional issues that were probably exacerbated by CTE, that this is like Hernandez is an unusually dramatic case because of how lurid the crimes he committed were and how badly he committed them.
Yeah.
It is not 100% an outlier.
Yeah. I really don't think it is. And there's another aspect of this that I thought was interesting. They interview this guy who was a friend of one of the victims, Odin Lloyd, and they played semi-pro football together, which I didn't realize was a thing. Like, semi-pro anything seems to me like something from like the late 40s, like just in these sort of corners of the country where it's like, well, we don't, we're going to do this because TV isn't really a thing yet.
Also, semi-pro football is hard because it's like, that's expensive equipment. Like, it's not the sort of thing, like, semi-pro basketball is basically, like, I don't, people betting on a game to 11 or something like that. Presumably that exists.
Yeah.
These guys had uniforms. They had referees.
Yeah.
If it's the dude that I think you're talking about, he's the most interesting person in the entire film.
Yes, agree. And I'm going to play a clip of him telling a story. And I pulled this because, first of all, it really gives you a flavor of, like, you know, life in Dorchester. And second of all, he's talking about the protection that is afforded by playing this sport and being known for playing this sport, even at this quite a bit lower level. But then I think that football doesn't sort of actively protect, like, it'll allow you to be protected in certain ways, like, you know, not getting hung up if you get in a bar fight in Tallahassee, or not like getting killed by a drug dealer in Dorchester. But then when you actually need protection from concussions, right, from whatever, from like not really knowing how to hear no because you never have since you were 13, football's not set up for that. So anyway, here's clip three.
Either you're on the drugs or you're selling the drugs or you're somewhere around. If you ain't selling it, then you're helping the drug dealers. You're going to the store for them. Or you're doing things that they can't do because they can't leave the block. Odin grew up in that. I mean, I literally had time to do. I'd be dating a girl and come out of her house and I would have a gun stuck to my neck because I'm in the hallway and dudes would be doing a drug deal or something and they say, who the fuck are you? And before I could even speak, someone would crack their door. Leave him alone. He's just a football guy. They'd be like, that's right. You played against my cousin 2 weeks ago. You had 100 yards and 3 touchdowns. My fault, man. Yo, I saw that game. And I'm like, thank you, football. Thank you, football.
I mean, modest proposal. Just follow that guy around and have him tell stories for like an hour a week. Subscribe right now.
It's also, so his name's Mike Massey. He is, as you said, like a teammate of Odin Lloyd's. Not only is he extremely compelling and good at talking, the sports media people that appear in this, almost without exception, are like poignantly inarticulate. And that guy is just like super magnetic, has a perspective on things, has, as Jim Rome says, a take.
Yeah.
And doesn't suck. And yet, like, the, you know, when it comes time to get the actual insight on, like, you know, being an NFL player, the only people they can talk to are like sports radio goofs and, you know, print mag guys.
I just love, like, there's even the sound of the door slamming. It's perfect. Yeah. I can absolutely picture everything about that hallway, which light bulb was burned out, what color beige it's painted. Like, that guy.
Yeah. It's also definitely telling that you have to be that far outside of the actual institution of big-time football to actually have that kind of perspective on it.
Yeah.
That all of the other guys, I mean, Jermaine Wiggins, who's like a journeyman NFL tight end who's now a Boston sports radio guy, appears a lot in the second and third installments. And as a guy that, you know, played in the NFL, played the same position as Hernandez, you'd think that he'd have more to say about, you know, the way that the sort of the dynamics of it work and sort of the way that the give and get between player and organization works. And he just does not. No insights of any note.
Yeah. Or he did. And his bosses were like, right. You're not using that, I'm sure.
Yeah. So just talk about how, like, you'd be mad in this situation, maybe. Can you work with that?
Yeah. Which, I mean, it's really a pity because I would be, you know, I think that that processy stuff is interesting. And I think it's relevant to this because the fact is, if you're looking at the facts of these cases, like you said, Hernandez did it, and he did it in the just suckiest, clumsiest fashion that was practically like, you know, why don't you just like drive up to the cop shop and tap on the front door with the butt of the gun while you're up?
Yeah. It was all coming back to me as, you know, they sort of laid out the actual crimes he committed. It at one point, like, so he didn't clean up after himself at this murder scene, which was, you know, less than a mile from his home in a town where, like, not that many people live. I've actually been to North Attleboro, Mass. I have fired a gun in North Attleboro, Mass at a shooting range. It's, like, a just bumpkin-ass Massachusetts town. I didn't even know it had, like, a mega mansion district where people like Aaron Hernandez lived. But at one point, so beyond leaving his spent shell casings at the site, he also spit out some blue bubblicious gum, which when the cops came to his house, like 2 days later, he like offered a piece of that gum from the same pack to a fucking cop.
Well, and it's this ridiculous, I just found something about that very like heartbreaking.
Yeah, that it's like this, a cry for help. I mean, it's like arrest me.
Like necklace. Like brain damaged murderer, choose this extremely childlike, disgusting gum that most people would age out of, but he's just like blue cotton candy. Like, dude, no.
Yeah, he's like, I want something that's the only flavor it has is sweet. But do you have it in a Muppet colorway?
Yeah, it really is like Muppet. That's the flavor.
God.
Muppet.
Which, Muppet, yeah, I mean,
baby.
They shouldn't.
Yes.
I was going to, but you can't, it's really unethical to use real Muppets in that. They have, the flavor community has advanced a lot with that. Most of it's done with flowers now. The
blue flowers, like in nature. Yeah,
right. The kind that you see everywhere you go. I mean, that's also another thing that's like kind of mentioned in passing, that Hernandez was just stoned nonstop all the time.
Yeah.
So again, there's a kind of like Coen Brothers-y poignance to how bad the crime is, because the guy's mind just isn't working right for a million different reasons, none of which the film really necessarily has much insight into, but all of which it at least amply illustrates.
Yeah, I read a book about the case a couple of years back, which is not great. It's part of that James Patterson series, and it's like there's a lot of facts arranged in a clunky order, and like it gets the job done. But the book was actually much better at putting a, like, hanging a light on the fact that there wasn't a piss test he could pass anywhere.
Yeah.
And didn't. Like, he just used other people's pee. And this is where he and his agent are at when he's in jail. Just to give you a sense, like, that they have to know they're being recorded.
Yep.
And here's what's happening. Clip 4.
Dude, I'm still trying to get you. I'm still trying to get you marketing deals. It's not so easy, man. I talked to Nike the other day, and they said that it's really hard to put the Nike swooshes on orange jumpsuits.
Yeah, I know.
But no, everything is good, dude. Everything is good.
Hey, can you get me a Smith & Wesson deal?
No, I cannot get you a Smith & Wesson deal. You fuck.
I mean,
yeah, kind of makes you wonder how long that guy could have gone without accidentally committing some serious crime. Just like more or less because he was like, he forgot what cars were supposed to do.
Yeah. The Swiss cheese of the CTE and his brain, like something was going to go horribly wrong probably pretty soon, whether he was at like advancing intent with it or not.
Yeah. I mean, this is the part of it that, like, the thing that's actually, like, if you care about football, that's, like, interesting about the movie is that, like, there are all these contributing factors, all of which are, like, in retrospect, but I imagine at the moment, you know, if you were actually close enough to him, all of them are huge red flags. I mean, just, like, the lack of what, there's a scouting report described it as social maturity, but just basically, again, like, the fact that finished high school at 17, finished college at 20, like, you know, is sort of... First, he was told nothing but no. Then he was never told no in his life.
Yeah. Like,
that plus all of this confluence of other sorts of identity and substance and circumstance. It just, like, it wasn't going to – it doesn't seem like it was ever really going to end well for him, and it wasn't exactly clear who was trying to help him.
Yeah. And this is where Killer Inside, I think – maybe should have renamed or repunctuated itself like Killer Inside, because I'm just not convinced that nobody else bears responsibility. Not that he doesn't, and you know, but like,
no, I agree. I mean, just in the sense that it seems like
are we going to get Urban Meyer to be like, yeah, I should have stepped in? No. But
no, I mean, all these guys, it's just like it's a business to them that this is just sort of like a thing that goes by on the assembly line and you put your little stamp on it and it increases in value and then it's gone. And the next thing is already sort of heaving down the conveyor belt towards you. There's no fucking insight from Bill Belichick or Urban Meyer. Right. Like, I mean, that's not the business that they're in.
No.
But like, you don't have to take it at face value that these guys are geniuses or care about anything other than, you know, getting the maximum result on the field. I mean, like Belichick in his bearing, in his general approach to interactions with the public, just everything about the fuck you vibe that guy puts off is him telling you, I don't care about any of this. Like, I care about getting from like A to B. That's my job.
Well, or that he would prefer that it be a closed courtroom proceeding.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's okay with cameras there, but actual other people with whom he has to interact, he would rather just Bartleby over to the side. Like, in the clip that we heard in the visual, I'm pretty sure he's wearing black socks and shower shoes because Belichick.
Yep. Yeah. So I've been in the same room with him once at a I was at, I guess, what was probably the biggest or best breakout game that Hernandez had. It's either the I think it was the AFC Championship. It was basically the last game where Tim Tebow was relevant.
Right. Okay.
In Foxborough. And Hernandez was beyond like unstoppable in that game. He caught passes, but they also, I think they show a little bit of this. They used him out of the backfield, which like was just not something that gets done with tight ends. Like there's some teams will use them as like pass catchers or blockers out of there. They handed him the ball multiple times during that game because it became clear that there was just nobody on the Broncos who could tackle him before he'd gone 15 yards. And it was a route. It was a route within 5 minutes. I mean, and Tebow had this great win the week before. I remember I was sitting next to a woman from People magazine in the press box who was like, she was like, if Tebow wins, I have to write a story about it. But because he didn't, she was off the hook.
Right.
And but the vibe of Belichick, so this team won by 40 points. The game was never in doubt. And I went to the briefing in the bowels of Foxborough State, Gillette Stadium, whatever. And he was beyond being like the grayest, like physically the grayest person I've ever seen. Like just... not his hair, but like his skin and his general vibe.
He's like the Conrad Bain of football.
Yeah.
He's all one color and it's the color of no color.
Yeah. Color of water.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the one thing that this undersells is that, so you can tell that he doesn't want to talk, right? Or that he doesn't have time for your shit or your dumb question about something that he, you know, whatever, doesn't really feel compelled to share with fans or with you. There's an aggressiveness to him that sort of comes through in stuff like that. Like, he's nastier. He's not withdrawn. Like, there is an aggressiveness with to the way that he fobs that stuff off. Just a guy that, you know, for whatever his results and whatever he is able to draw out of otherwise troubled athletes, is not a guy who is going to trouble himself personally with whatever, you know, problems an immature guy on his team might be having. It's just, it doesn't, unless he thought that it would deliver the outcome that he wanted, which, you know, it would for a while. It just, that's not a guy that should be taking care of someone with as many problems as Aaron Hernandez.
Yeah. And it's not someone whom we should expect to take care of someone like that, because that person has suffered
family
physical
life, yeah,
trauma that is not reversible, and that Belichick's not a neurologist, and Belichick's getting paid to do a job that doesn't involve sitting a guy like Hernandez who doesn't give a shit and will just run until he hits a wall and possibly pass then. So
yeah.
But like, this is all stuff. This is a conversation you and I could have had without watching this documentary.
Yeah, I was just thinking that this is like, there's nothing that's in here necessarily informs it. Like, it's interesting to get to meet Mike Massey. Like, mm-hmm. He seems very compelling. As you said, I'm all for, like, you know, untitled Mike Massey project.
Yes, ditto.
But the other stuff about the culture of football and the sort of the dynamic of this, like, flubby gangland world into which Hernandez fell or drifted or whatever, none of that is deeply understood or deeply compellingly expressed enough that it really changes anything about, like, what I understood going in to be primarily the story here.
Yeah. And as well, I'm not entirely convinced. And, like, again, I'm not, like, I don't not care about the NFL, but I also kind of don't care. Yeah. Like, there's only room for a couple sports in my brain, and that's not one of them.
I've had to do that with other sports too. That's just part of being a grown person. Like, and even as I, like, you know, still notionally, I don't have a job now, but I mean, I notionally write about sports. At some point you have to be like, I don't, like, owe college football my Saturday afternoon. Like, I owe that to my friends or my wife or my life.
Yeah.
You know, and the NFL is, I found it extremely easy to kind of just dial down my level of engagement with it. 'Cause, like, you know, it can be fun, but, like, it's fucking evil.
Yeah. And it's, there's just a lot, like, now that I'm no longer in a fantasy football league, I'm like, I give myself permission to not care about this anymore. But
yeah,
I think that if you're going to make an entire, like, a 3-hour docuseries about this, you have to be, you have to understand that that's really your best, most interesting angle. And I'm not convinced that this production necessarily knew what questions it should have been asking of football of the football adjacent people they were able to get. Like, is Tom Brady going to sit down and be like, you know, here's my diary entry from blah, 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 and when I bitched about, you know, Aaron Hernandez's emotional lability? Like, no, mm-hmm. That's not happening.
Yeah. And it's not just a Patriots thing either. I mean, this is the limit with any of this stuff, that, like, the NFL is extremely protective of its brand, as we said earlier, but also, like, it's not a culture of insight. And so, like, it's a question of who you have access to and what you can do with it.
Yeah,
and exactly. In this case, the NFL guys, that there's some former Patriots that they have in here. They have one player, Ryan O'Callaghan, who played for the Patriots and then later came out as gay and offers some insight to a certain extent on what it's like to be gay in a locker room and you know, how difficult that can be, and a little bit into the Patriots way as well, you know, under Belichick. But again, with all of that, it's like none of those circuits quite close.
Yeah.
All of these episodes feel kind of, I mean, given that it's a 3-part thing of, you know, that tells, it covers a period of time chronologically. And yet I thought the first and the second one felt almost exactly the same. And for a while I thought they were going to end in the same place.
Yeah.
And was kind of wondering, like, where, it's hard to tell what they wanted to make the argument be. The one that, as you said, like winds up landing most heavily is that Hernandez's brain was wrecked by CTE, and that all of the stuff that would lead somebody to commit these sorts of like impulsive crimes, like doing a drive-by on two guys because they spilled a drink on you in a club, that's CTE shit, like impulse control and wild mood swings and violence. Like those are symptomatic of that disorder. But that's a one part thing, man. That's your film if you want to make it, right?
Yeah. Or make it like, I don't know, 13 and a half short films about Aaron Hernandez. Pick a different, precipitating stressor, put a different director on each one and be like, okay, it was familial shit that he never got over. And that one's 27 minutes long. And then you end at the same point. You end at the same chronological point in each one, but each film is like, here's where the journey was from the perspective of the possibility that he was closeted and that was having its customary deleterious effect on his psyche, and just do
that's
it that
a
way.
Way better idea. That's a very good idea, especially because it would give you the same sort of, in the same way that like there's something frustrating about the end of this, because it's like, not just because none of the circuits are completely completed, you know, that it's not like the sort of thing where you, but it also like, it sort of nibbles and feints and gestures in different directions without landing any of it. And like, that's a completely reasonable way to understand a senseless crime and a short, unhappy, tragic life. It's just like, if it were understood in greater depth and sort of expressed as being like the fundamental unknowability of it, instead of being like that kind of like magisterial where it like looks like the ESPN OJ doc, but it doesn't actually have the goods.
Well, yeah, I was going to make that comparison. Then it's like the at the center of that crime, of OJ Simpson's crime, is, well, we know why, and yet we don't. And he's never going to admit anything to us. But those filmmakers smartly were like, here is everything that brought us to this point and then carried us away.
Yep.
So,
and that's like, I think that's how you do, especially as a write around, you know, like just thinking about it as like a sort of a journalistic task.
Yeah.
Like that's how you can still tell a compelling and interesting and like, and actually, like, revealing story, even if you don't have the, you know, killed them all, of course, audio clip to, like, knot the whole thing up at the end.
Yeah, because, you know, when are you ever going to have that? Once. And it already happened.
Right.
So
it was a fucking accident.
Figure something
from, like, a
else out.
Burping
or
psychopath.
What are we doing here?
Yeah. Like, having the burping psychopath moment cannot be your, that's not a game plan.
Yeah.
Right there. Can't do it.
Yeah. Even those guys are like, term. Well, we retire. Good night. All right, well, Killer Inside, The Mind of Aaron Hernandez, it's not like I'm not angry. It's not a waste. It is competently made. But if you know,
very easy to watch.
Yeah. But if you know anything about the case, you don't need it. And if you don't know anything about the case, sure. Like, put this
on.
I
guess, yeah.
But wasted opportunity, I would say.
Yeah, more Massey.
Yeah, more Massey.
You blew it.
Untitled Massey Project. Universe, hear our cry.
Come in 2021. Can you add an air horn there?
how about this?
don't do it.
Eh?
Right on.
All right, moving along to our cold case section. We wound up watching the Tillman story because you, David J. Roth, were reading Where Men Win Glory. Is that the name of it?
That is the name of it.
Okay.
Kind of a corny name for a very good book.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think once you start with things like Into the Wild and Into Thin Air, your publisher's like, what about this grandiose thing? And you're like, all right.
Yeah.
The check.
Like, sure. All right, I guess technically they were under the banner of heaven. I mean, we all are, right? So.
Yeah. Also, yeah. Your book substantively is about men who claim that they committed a murder because the angel Moroni. That's moron. I
know.
Invaded them anally. Like,
I've
call it whatever you want.
Never gotten over that. The name.
All right. Here's the case file for the Tillman story. This is from Peter Travers's review for Rolling Stone. Quote, If the Army had its way, you would remember Corporal Pat Tillman as an NFL star. He was a safety for the Arizona Cardinals, who died in combat in Afghanistan in 2004. In fact, Tillman was accidentally killed by his own unit. The Army and the Bush administration preferred to alter the facts and make Tillman, who had grown increasingly disillusioned with the war, the poster boy for military glorification. End quote. So I didn't reread the book to prepare for this, but I had read it before. This might be sort of like a neighborhood play in terms of it being true crime, but I suspect the book is a little more explicit in alleging or theorizing that Tillman was actually killed because he was beginning to have an anti-war attitude.
It is not, it's mentioned in there.
Okay.
So the book, I should say that the version of it that I read this is just me transforming into my actual father-in-law. I just like buy things at Goodwill for 99 cents now if they look interesting, and I read them and then I just give them back. It's cool. Ladies love it. I know it sounds cool, but I'm not doing it for clout. This is just me having fun. But it's a paperback edition, and it's like, I guess, significantly expanded from even the first paperback edition and certainly the hardback, because like more shit kept coming out. If there's a crime here, it's the cover up. It's the military's, they did like 7 investigations of this thing.
Yeah,
each one more fucking ghastly and selective than the last. There was a conspiracy. I think there still kind of is. And this is like mentioned in the book that like a bit of, there's like an Associated Press story that, so Tillman was killed by what they call like a squad automatic weapon, which is a huge gun mounted on a fucking Jeep. It fires the same bullets that the M4, which is the like military weapon that, you know, everybody in the Army is issued. Like, it fires the same caliber bullets as that, but it fires, you know, hundreds of them in a minute.
Right.
You know, like, which is a very, or whatever, however long it is. I'm not going to pretend I care or know about guns. But I did read this book, and it's not completely vanished from my memory yet. So, like, those bullets hit Pat Tillman and basically blew his head apart.
Yes.
But because the bullets that did it were very closely grouped, which, like, an elite Army Ranger guy would be able to do from 60 yards away. But the AP story that created this conspiracy theory that he was like either fragged by his own people or that he had been killed was basically like the intensity of that weapon was such that it was the same as if he had been shot from like 10 or 15 feet away with an M4 instead of being shot from more than half a football field away by the same caliber bullet.
Right.
I'm happy to answer any other questions about ballistics that you have.
It did start to remind me of Mortal Error, which is like, the, as far as I'm concerned, the end of the story when it comes to what happened to JFK's skull and the fact that the front of it was gone. But, I'm not convinced that, I'm easy to convince that the Army will fuck something up. I'm easy to convince that they will try to cover up that fact. But that they would be able to keep this entire thing a secret, like if they had him killed, like that's like a level to, you know, that's a level that I don't think they can achieve. Certainly.
Absolutely agree. That's like credulity that like every conspiracy theory requires, where you have to be like impossibly cynical and impossibly credulous at the same time to like make any of that stuff stick together.
That it's like, I don't know. Like, it's sort of like the president. Well, actually, no. It's nothing.
You're right. This is
nothing is
the
like the president, and
the
I'm just
rule.
Not even going to wade in there.
But in the book and also in the film, I think that this is in there that like for all of the way that war was sort of sold in public, you know, it's like these night vision photos of laser guided missiles and whatever. The book and the film, Tillman's entire experience in the Army, and a lot of those other ones that are included in there, is just an orgy of fuck-ups and failures and, like, shitty cover your ass maneuvers from upstairs, Donald Rumsfeld rushing people just because he's an asshole, and then, you know, things that don't work. The reason that Tillman was killed in large part was that, like, these guys' radios just didn't work. They hardly ever worked.
Yeah.
And the reason that they were even in this situation that they were in, where, like, they wound up sort of where two breakout units of the same, like, Ranger division could have been shooting at each other, was that they were dragging around a wrecked Humvee.
Yeah.
Because they weren't allowed to blow it up. They couldn't leave it there. And there was this whole back and forth with headquarters about, like, where it needed to be taken through impossibly difficult terrain so that it could be then picked up by, like, a heavy wrecker.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Like, Afghanistan is not Kansas. It's all hill. They're real steep.
And the areas where they were just, like, it's not the last place. There's a reason why, like, Afghanistan has, I would say, a poor reputation as a place to pick a fight.
Yeah.
Just, like, incredibly bad at every level. Like, and that's the feeling that the documentary and then especially the book sort of has, is just, like, there's no single failure in there that does not compound three times over.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of like the Aaron Hernandez story in that way, that it's like, yep. Was it this? It wasn't not that. Like, there's a gazillion things.
Everything that's bad gets worse, and there's, like, a dozen bad things. Yeah. That is definitely a commonality.
Like, the fact that I lost track of where everyone was, despite the fact that they're basically using a telestrator in this documentary, and I'm like, this is so confusing to me. Like, I still have no concept of what exactly was supposed to have happened based on this diagram. And then
and it's not a fault of filmmaking. I mean, I think in some ways, like, that sort of works. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it's all impossibly hard to follow, even once you get past the, like, wait, why is any of this happening again factor, which is strong.
And then Pat Tillman turns to his the guy that he's basically the sensei for, and is like, well, I'm just going to take off this bulky body armor so that I can actually get up this hill, which is like a, whatever, 62% grade.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have helped him anyway, because he got hit in the head. But there's nothing quite like the Arby's willingness not just to immediately lie and cover up something like this, but to send a kid who's not even old enough to rent a car to lie to the family for them, instead of sending, like, a major to do it. No, we're just gonna send this kid.
There's so much of that too. Guys that, like, knew, and there was in the book, I don't remember if he's in the film, they sent a guy to make a speech on the Army's behalf at Tillman's funeral. That had, like, it was a Navy SEAL that Tillman and his brother, who'd enlisted at the same time, had befriended.
Yeah.
And it was just fucking full of lies. And this guy admired Tillman up and down, like, they were buddies.
Yeah.
And they just dispatched him to go tell some cockamamie official story to, like, thousands of grieving people, including his wife, his family, his parents. It's unbelievable how shameless and shitty it all is, even if you have a very vivid memory of how dumb and bad that time was.
None of this should be a surprise to anyone who's ever had to deal with the Army. Here's clip 6 and Pat Tillman's family just talking about how they sent this child to say functionally nothing, and this the story only holds for, like, a few weeks. Here's clip 6.
The position he was in while he was over at the house was, I'm sure, very awkward. It appeared very awkward. At the time, it seemed that he was still very upset and rattled by the whole setting and Pat's death, because he liked Pat a lot.
I went into Pat's mom's living room, and I gave them, you know, my narrative, excluding certain possibilities.
And Russell Bear told us nothing. Initially, I was not real pleased with Russell Bear. It upset me that this kid, supposed to be a friend of the family's, didn't say anything. But we found out about 5 weeks later the reason.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this documentary is very good at accruing, like, steadily accruing Army horseshit and Defense Department horseshit, so that you, even if you're pretty like cynical about this going in, you're still boggling at it.
Yeah. It stands out even better, I think, in contrast with the Hernandez thing too, because this is like a lean 90 minutes.
Yeah.
But it does, like, it accumulates very steadily, where, like, it gets, you know, as you said, like, even the sort of, like, baseline level of fuckery that you'd expect here is, like, just, it always gets worse.
Yeah. I'm going to skip ahead to clip 9, because there's this guy, Goff, who I believe was in the armed forces, and now is, like, a consultant for the family. I was a little unclear.
He's like it's hard. He was a blogger that... Yeah. Tillman's grief-stricken mom, who did this heroic investigative effort, enlisted to help her. But yeah, it wasn't exactly... He himself was like a former Army Ranger or Special Forces guy. It's unclear how he keeps the lights on, but he's very compelling to listen to.
Yeah, except this moment at the end where they're doing yet another set of hearings about the death of Tillman, and people are basically, I don't recalling, their way through... the provenance of some facts about Tillman's demise, and here's clip 9.
Yeah. General Abaze didn't get the facts, and there was a mix-up at the office. That's a good one.
Probably the 6th. It's a guess. I can't be sure exactly the date.
Abaze is responsible for the entire Middle East and North Africa, and this guy's not going to be informed?
Well, if he's responsible for basically whole continents... Maybe no. Like, yeah. I know Tillman was a high-profile guy, but A, probably no. B, sir, have you met the Army? Of course this happened. Also, faxing. Come on.
Even though we're talking about 2003 or 2004, yeah. I don't think anybody ever... Like, most people don't get faxes.
Yeah.
Faxes are sent primarily as pranks.
Yeah. Or, like, but they curl up and roll away.
That's the whole idea. That's why they built them like that. They're designed to be unscrolled as a joke, and it's like a picture of a butt on it.
Exactly.
The thing with this that's interesting, though, that I think they're getting at that point, and that both the book and the film sort of deal with, is that there's this tremendous squeeze on the people that are caught in the middle of all of this from this, like, the feckless kind of, like, Rumsfeld, and then this, like, PR apparatus that was, like, this really powerful part of his Pentagon, down onto then these, like, sort of career general types who basically are upper middle management, you know, at any sort of workplace, where they just basically exist to sort of talk to each other and periodically fall on their sword as needed.
Yeah.
But then everything below that is just a fucking clusterfuck of conflict and bad information and panic, you know, to an end that nobody even much further up the chain seems to understand. That, like, it's never exactly clear why Tillman and his team had to go clear the village that they were supposed to clear, beyond the fact that on the timetable that they had to do it on, beyond the fact that, like, Rumsfeld was yelling at somebody who then yelled at somebody who then yelled at somebody. And somewhere along the line, you're dragging a wrecked Humvee through a box canyon and getting shot at by your own guys.
To look busy, possibly?
Yeah, I think that's it. To look like you're going fast.
Yeah.
But, like, going fast where?
And,
you know, like,
unfortunately, the only thing you should be doing fast is leaving, and that's not
an option. We're still working on that one.
There's also... I don't know. I don't recall how good the book is at this, but the film, in addition to making me want to also watch the untitled Richard Tillman Project, because
he's the Mike Massey of this one for sure.
He absolutely is. At like the worst moment of his life too. The contrast between the just, like, very empty, carefully read platitudes about Tillman's sacrifice, and then this dude getting up in cargo shorts, drinking a Guinness, and just letting it rip.
Yeah.
Clip 8 is a little long, but I felt it was important for texture.
You won't be mad.
No, you really won't.
Got people out there sort of speaking in these glittering generalities.
Pat, your family doesn't have to worry anymore. You are home, you are safe, and you will not be forgotten.
And then you've got a brother coming up there, somebody who's willing to speak the brutality of that reality for them.
He was always given gifts. Thanks, Pat. I didn't write shit, because I'm not a writer. And I just want to say there's a lot of people here, thanks. It was really amazing to be his little baby brother. Yeah, I'm not just going to sit up here and break down on you, but thanks for coming. Pat's a fucking champion, and always will be. Just make no mistake, he'd want me to say this. He's not with God. He's fucking dead. He's not religious, so thanks for your thoughts, but he's fucking dead.
Thanks for your thoughts, but he's fucking dead.
I mean, it's honestly well said, right? After John McCain gets up there and talks about, like, commended into the hands of a loving God or whatever.
Fucking Maria Shriver, like, of all people, to be like, yeah, Here's what your family needs to be. That, like, girl, no. But he's safe now? He's got no head, Gene.
Yeah, right. He was fucking sick. Like, he was a lot safer before you put him in a position where he's getting shot with a massive rifle.
Like, who told you about this funeral? Like, how'd you know we were going to be here?
That's the part. Yeah, seriously. She doesn't even go here.
I'm Canadian. You don't know me. Okay.
But there is that, like, definite, I mean, all of it, just all the opportunism the book goes into, and the film also goes into a little bit, the Jessica Lynch story, which was one that I had completely fucking
same
from the early days of Iraq. And it's all so, like, unbelievably broad and phony. It's, like, insulting beyond the fact that it's all untrue, like, made-for-TV spectacle designed to paint, you know, whatever, Iraqis as subhumans and Americans as this, like, incredibly precise military force. It just sucks. It's baby shit.
It really does seem, and I do feel like we were all pretty disillusioned at this point.
Yeah.
But I also seem to remember thinking, well, Abu Ghraib will get him out for sure, and it didn't. So. Yeah. That was,
it's like the end
November.
Of Vietnam or something, where it's like, as soon as you admit one of these errors, like, you have to fucking go. Like, you just can't stick around. And yet somehow it's like decades on, and like no one can quite be like, all right, well, obviously this didn't work out. Our bad.
Yeah. Like, last one out, turn off the lights. Like, I don't know, but that's why. That's why I'm not a, you know, 3-star general.
Yeah.
Here's the point. The United States military-industrial complex is terrible. I do think that this documentary, I was surprised to learn that this was by the same director who directed Happy Valley, which was about the Paterno, Penn State, Sandusky.
I didn't see that. Was it any good?
It was good, but I wanted it to be better. I think it was made maybe too soon, mm-hmm, after everything had been sort of revealed and was happening.
Yeah.
Maybe a little more distance. Like, I think Paterno maybe died, like, while they were editing it. It was that close together.
That happened to a Joe Posnanski book that he was supposed to write, some sort of, like, dads and grads book about Paterno, and then the whole story broke when he was there. And it became like a career, basically a career obliterating thing for a guy that I always admired a lot as a sports writer.
I remember writing about that on Tomato Nation and just thinking, like, he's just got to be, like, in his whatever room at the Sheraton, just, like, staring into his lap, like, well.
Yeah, like, what the hell happened to me? Like, I was supposed to just be talking about, like, how to make a linebacker, and
but he's got the Houdini book out, and that was really good, so.
That's true. Yeah, I'm glad he was. I interviewed him a million years ago. He was a very nice man. So
yeah.
I'm glad that he's well.
He'll be all right. That was just one of those. I just remember, like, smelling a mushroom cloud detonating.
Seriously. It's like as bad as it could possibly be. It seems like I've thought that this was a little bit more in depth than I sort of assumed for whatever reason that Alex Gibney had directed this, because he directs like one out of every three documentaries.
That's true. Yeah.
On film. And it's a little more careful than a lot of the Gibney stuff winds up being.
Yeah. I think it's good. I also think it sort of stays within itself in terms of what it's trying to do. Mm-hmm. And certainly like they got the participation of the family without much reservation. Apparently the family was not terribly keen on the Crack Hour project.
They were some more than others, but yes, this one definitely has more of those voices in it.
He also directed I feel like nobody saw this except me, and I don't even really care about the Grateful Dead. I just like documentaries, but there was a documentary series on Amazon about the Grateful Dead directed by this guy that I thought was really great. So
really, I'm sure that I have like friends that have seen it and just like know enough not to talk to me about it.
But fair.
Yeah. I could certainly see. I mean, that's also a documentary series seems like I would trust this guy to do that in terms of like, he seems like he understands like chapters and storytelling in a way that like could be very useful with that instead of it just sort of piling up.
Yeah, I think generally speaking and Happy Valley, again, was not bad, but I think generally he has a pretty good ear for like what the story is, how long it's supposed to be, and where he's supposed to, like which roads he's supposed to take us on. So mm-hmm. I actually would not mind him taking a crack at Aaron Hernandez instead.
Absolutely. I was thinking something very similar, not just because, you know, they're a part of the same podcast that we're appearing on now as we speak. But it does seem like that, like, just an understanding of, like, what you can leave out and what you can't is missing from the Hernandez thing, which winds up being, you know, more than twice as long and, I would say, about half as effective.
Yeah, and this is sort of shaped with the Aaron Hernandez felt a little bit like, you know, the pre-writing of a obituary mm-hmm. is a thing that happens, and this felt a little bit like here are the obligatory, you know, facty sections that we have to put in to bring everyone up to speed. Like, I just don't think anybody who is watching this is that green on the topic that you have to be this broad. So
it's definitely, it has that, just to compare it to like writing stuff too. It's like, if once you do all the work and do all these interviews and stuff, there's definitely this temptation to then put it in to show people.
Oh, sure.
And to show yourself that you weren't wasting your fucking time.
Oh yeah.
And a lot of it just didn't necessarily add up. Like all the courtroom stuff, which I guess is what judging by the promotional material they were touting, like the phone calls were illuminating. The courtroom stuff was that.
Yeah, it's true.
What are you going to do? You gonna make another one. Give me another 3 hours and 20 minutes. See if you can't get it right this time. We got $14 billion to spend in online streaming content this year. We can't afford to get this wrong twice.
Yeah, it's true. All right. Well, the Tillman story, I think, is a worthwhile hour and 35 minutes. The director is Amir Bar-Lev. Once again, he also did Happy Valley and Long Strange Trip. For, I think, Amazon. I recommend both of those, and I recommend this. It's a good overview, and unfortunately, it really does put you back at another recent time in American history where everyone was staring at something happening and being like, how is this still happening? And yet it still was for a while.
Yep, good stuff.
Yeah. Speaking of things that are still happening.
Yeah.
In local news today, bees.
Mr. Roth, do you have anything to plug? Where else can listeners find you and your work?
I am still kind of freelancing while I make some moves on broader projects, which is a good way of saying that I'm mostly freelancing. But the, you know, I do the Hallmark podcast with Jeb Lund, which is called Dave and Jeb Aren't Mean. And there'll be some new episodes of that forthcoming. Jeb's had some health stuff, but is working on it. And then, I don't know. I mean, like, I'll spam the different stories that I write on my Twitter account, which is @David_J_Roth. And you can also find them on the account that we created for everybody in the greater Deadspin diaspora, which is at Undeadspin. But, yeah.
Excellent. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been delightful.
Thanks for having me. This was fun. I would love to do it again immediately.
Excellent.
All right. But yeah, thanks.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Stephanie Early Green on Ted Bundy, Falling for a Killer, Toby Ball on Interrogation from CBS All Access, and Eve and I will be on Extra Hot Great to talk about McMillions. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram, and in the Best Evidence newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. If we have 2,000 paid subscribers by August, we'll cover the Theranos trial in person. My guest has been David J. Roth. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.